and community organizations come together to help those in northern Minnesota. I'm Gracie J. The governor has called a special election for House District 34B, which covers parts of Brooklyn Park, Champlain, and Coon Rapids in the Twin Cities area. The seat has been vacant since the tragic deaths of former DFL leader Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, who were killed in a targeted political attack. Voters will head to the polls on Tuesday, September 16th. Because the timeline is short, election officials recommend dropping your ballot off in person. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. on September 16th. You can pre-register by September 9th or register at the polls on Election Day. After losing most of its federal funding, the Center for Victims of Torture has scaled back its work around the globe. In St. Paul, its healing center remains open, but the people it serves are facing new barriers to stability and healing. Zan Holston has more.
Imagine you are undergoing surgery in an operating room.
Neil Porter is Director of International Services at the Center for Victims of Torture, or CVT, a Minnesota-based global leader in mental health care for victims of torture around the world.
Now imagine, mid-surgery and without explanation, the surgeon and her team are ordered to leave the operating room, unable to return, leaving you stranded, alone, exposed, and unhealed.
Porter is describing what he said started happening to CVT earlier this year when sweeping executive orders from President Trump cut its funding by 75% and demanded it stop its overseas operations. The order slashed CVT's budget from $38 million to $11 million, forcing mass layoffs.
We've laid off more than 400 people globally, including 25 here in Minnesota.
In May, CVT sued the Trump administration, arguing it was unconstitutional for it to withhold funding that had already been approved by Congress. But those cuts were finalized in July when Congress approved a rescission package that legally slashed $9 billion from programs like the U.S. Agency for International Development, a major funding source for CVT. CVT is still fighting that decision in court, but the damage has already been done. Hundreds of staff gone, and programs around the world shut down almost overnight. CVT's international programs have been hit the hardest, but its healing center in St. Paul is also feeling the strain. Jill Davidson is social services lead there.
Torture is an experience that really isolates people.
The healing center provides social and mental health support for survivors of torture, many of whom are seeking asylum in the U.S. Davidson said one of the most important first steps is establishing trust with clients.
To be consistent, to be reliable, to tell people what they can expect, and to follow through.
But increasingly aggressive immigration enforcement is disrupting that consistency.
You understand we're out with immigration, okay? We have a warrant for your arrest, right?
Davidson said many clients are afraid to come to the center or even leave their homes to go to work, leading to more isolation.
We have seen a huge increase in mental health symptoms, and many of the people who had shown great progress in their recovery have regressed within an extremely short period of time.
New rules and increased fees for asylum seekers are also sowing confusion, making the path toward citizenship even more challenging. Asylum seekers, many of whom arrive in the U.S. with little to nothing, must pay for an attorney, then wait 5 months before they can even apply for a work permit. Previously free, that application now costs hundreds of dollars.
They're depending on people in their community for everything they need because they have no way to make their own money.
Davidson said the rules punish the very people who need help the most, forcing them deeper into fear and instability.
I do wonder what our American values are when we treat newcomers this way.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Residents of northern Minnesota who are struggling financially are getting access to some extra help next week. Local agencies and nonprofits are coming together to host the first ever Community Connect event in Ely on Tuesday, September 9th. The free event includes a meal, free hygiene items, and housing support, as well as resources for older adults and families. Arrowhead Transit is providing free rides to and from the event on existing bus routes. The event is taking place at the Ely Area Community Hub from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. next Tuesday.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Today, the free speech debate in Forest Lake heats up, prompting police to remove a resident from a school board meeting. Then, a northern county is seeking solutions to its housing shortage. And more driverless cars are going to be on the streets of north central Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. Police removed the man from the Forest Lake School Board's August meeting after he criticized the board president for displaying a car with a Confederate flag at a past event. Forest Lake is about 25 miles north of the Twin Cities. Under a new rule introduced by the board president, anyone removed from a meeting faces a 6-month ban from district committees. Repeat offenders will be barred from school property. The incident comes as the board weighs whether to drop language in the student dress code that bans Confederate flags, swastikas, and KKK imagery. The clash has drawn larger crowds, sparked public comment, and deepened divisions between the board president, the community, and even his fellow board members. In today's main story, like many places around the state, Cook County is facing a serious housing shortage that has officials in Minnesota's easternmost county searching for answers. Knock Bui has more.
With Lake Superior at its southern edge, people flock to Cook County for its beauty. But while visitors won't find a shortage of places to stay, year-round residents and those looking to move there are struggling to find a place to call home. Up-to-date information isn't available, but a few years ago, Grand Marais community radio station WTIP reported that the county assessor estimates some 70% of the housing stock in Cook County are second homes or cabins. Another 4% are vacation rentals. This leaves Cook County residents with very few options.
You know, that's something that the school struggles with every year as they have new teachers coming in, and they lose teachers every year who can't afford to stay here just because of what's available. The hospital struggles with that. You know, all of these different, what we'd think of as kind of basic services.
Kirsten Wisniewski has been reporting on housing for WTIP. She said there's a growing discussion about how to balance the needs of visitors and locals.
It really is shifting that outlook from saying, sure, we want people to be visiting, to how do we maintain that tourism economy without cutting off permanent residents' access to things like housing and services.
Jeff Brand heads the county's Housing Redevelopment Authority, or HRA. He said building more homes isn't going to be easy when there's so little land to build on.
About 10% of the land in Cook County is actually land that's developable. A lot of the shoreline is not developable. It's owned by the state of Minnesota or other entities.
Building on this terrain can also be quite a feat.
I'd say that the construction that has occurred for residential in particular was the easiest to build. It's a little bit more challenging to deal with either the bedrock or the other side of things, the wetlands.
Still, the HRA has just managed to complete a 51-unit mixed-income apartment. Another apartment building is set to open by the end of the year, Brand said. Local officials are also looking at zoning. The County Board of Commissioners just allowed for the creation of what's called Residential Open Space Overlay Districts, or ROSO districts. That means property owners who choose to rezone could build several small houses on a portion of their land. Wisniewski explained these districts would only be possible on land outside of Grand Marais and away from the lakefront.
And the other part of that that's helpful for folks who are looking to create slightly higher density, kind of neighborhood vibes on a single parcel, is that they can have shared resources like a shared driveway or a shared septic system.
The county is hosting a series of town halls this month to share more information about this new possibility. This is Knock Bui for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Go MARTI! The free driverless transit system is expanding beyond Grand Rapids in September. Amper's station, KAXE, reports that Go MARTI! Is adding 60 stops in Cohasset, Deer River, and Ball Club. The transit system is also expanding its hours to 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., Monday through Saturday, and 8 to 3 on Sundays. Since launching in 2002, the pilot program has aimed to fill gaps in existing rural transportation with 5 autonomous vehicles in Grand Rapids. Starting in September, Go MARTI! Will have more than 150 stops.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's stories, why Minnesota is suing TikTok. Then, as we approach the beginning of the school year, we take a look at the controversy and confusion around charter schools. And a Fond du Lac member is recognized for Native language revitalization. I'm Gracie J. Minnesota's attorney general is suing TikTok, alleging that the company prioritizes profit over the well-being of young adults. The lawsuit accuses the company of violating the state's consumer protection laws. The complaint, filed in Hennepin County District Court, says TikTok entangles young users in cycles of excessive use by preying on their underdeveloped brains. It also alleges the company is using unlicensed virtual currency that is sexually and financially exploiting young TikTok users. Next, charter schools have been a part of Minnesota's education for decades, but many people still don't know what exactly a charter school is and how they compare to public and private schools. Faya Adam helps us to sort it out.
Minnesota is the birthplace of charter schools. The first charter school in the nation opened here in 1992. Today, more than 170 charter schools operate across the state, serving tens of thousands of students. But for many, the definition of charter schools is still unclear.
I think parents and families are, and this extends back through the history of like public education in the United States, are always vying for opportunities, the best opportunities for their children, regardless of what structures those opportunities take.
Professor Brian Lazensky is an associate professor and chair of the Educational Studies Department at McAllister College.
Whether you're looking at traditional public schools, private schools, charter schools, they're all very different from each other. They all serve very different populations of students. They all have very different kind of like missions and purposes.
Unlike private schools, charter schools are public. They can't charge tuition, and they must admit students through a lottery when demand is higher than available seats. But unlike traditional districts, they're run independently.
Charter schools are not subject to a particular school board. So there's not a, like what people say is a democratic process to elect the people who would be managing those schools. They're managed by authorizers, and then they're managed by directors of the school.
Charter schools may offer unique curriculum or specialized programs that traditional districts may not provide.
Each charter school is very different in what they do. The charter school that I work at, we focus on an accelerated and inclusive curriculum for all students. So all of our students upon graduation have completed either calculus or a college level math course.
Dr. Kate Hinton, a doctor of education, is the executive director at Math and Science Academy in Woodbury in the Eastern Metro area.
Other charter schools focus on, you know, some will work with students who have struggled in every school, and so they're trying to find a different way to connect with those students. So charter schools just give another option to families.
Dr. Hinton says charter schools have little differences at the core compared to public school districts. For example, while Math and Science Academy is a charter school offering an accelerated curriculum, it doesn't restrict admission based on a student's performance.
We're still a public school. We still work, you know, we serve special education students. We don't get to do any admissions testing. Not that we would want to, but we don't do that. So admissions to math and science, we have long wait lists, so it's always a lottery.
More than 30 years after the first one opened, charter schools have become a permanent part of the state's educational landscape. This is Faya Adam for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. A Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa staff member is being honored for her leadership in Ojibwe language revitalization. The Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network has named Eliza Savage as one of three fellows for 2025-2026. The fellowship recognizes emerging leaders who use Ojibwe Mo'in in daily life. Each fellow receives a $10,000 award to support their work. Fond du Lac leaders say Savage is a shining example of the community's efforts to preserve and strengthen the Ojibwe language and culture.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
The woman accused of yelling racial slurs at a Black child in Rochester will likely face criminal charges. Then, Minnesota attracts athletes from around the globe for an international competition. And a court reverses the conviction of a pipeline protester in northern Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. The Rochester City Attorney's Office is filing a complaint summons against the woman accused of yelling racial slurs at a young Black child earlier this year. Video of the incident went viral on social media, sparking outrage against as well as support for Shiloh Hendricks, who will now likely face 3 counts of disorderly conduct. The charges carry a sentence of up to 90 days in jail and or a $1,000 fine. A district court judge still has to review and approve the charges. The city attorney says the decision to charge took longer than expected because of the sensitive and complicated nature of the incident. Up next, athletes from all over the world gathered at the Mall of America to compete in the USA Wheelchair Softball World Series. Catherine DeSell takes us to the tournament.
Best way to picture this game is close your eyes. You are coming up to the plate. It's the bottom of the ninth. You've got a runner on third. It's a tie game. It's you versus the pitcher. At no point did we say that you're in a wheelchair or you're going to have to run or push to first base. It's the same desire, it's the same game, it's that same athletic competitiveness. We just do it a little differently.
That's Jeff Downs, tournament director for the 2025 National Wheelchair Softball World Series. This summer, Minnesota hosted the tournament in the parking lot of the Mall of America with more than 300 athletes competing from states all across the U.S.
We had set up 5 fields in the north parking lot of Mall of America, and we played almost 60 games in 2.5 days, despite the weather and lightning strikes.
Wheelchair softball originated in the Midwest in 1976 and was created by athletes with spinal cord injuries who wanted to enjoy the game. It's very similar to typical softball, except it's played on a hard surface, such as a parking lot. Another big difference is that most players don't wear gloves, so they can easily move their wheelchairs to make plays.
The only people that wear gloves is typically the first baseman to try and snag those balls that are coming in at them hot. We use a 16-inch softball. It's a little softer than the standard ball. It's still going to hurt you when you get a line drive shot at you.
Anyone with a physical disability that is in a wheelchair can play. The teams are set up with athletes classified based on their abilities, with a range from 0 to 4.5.
As the coach puts their lineup together, they can only have a maximum of 28 points on the field at one time. A quadriplegic is going to play in that lower 0 to 1 maybe classification. A amputee could be up in the 4-5.
Jeff says the sport is growing in popularity with new players joining every year.
There is no residency rule, which means you can pick up a player, you can fly somebody in. This weekend, we had 4 people come over from the Netherlands as free agents, just saying, hey, who can I play with?
Jason Miller has been playing wheelchair softball for 23 years.
A buddy of mine was like, hey, you need to come out and try softball. I got hooked immediately. I was like, this might be the coolest thing I've ever done in my life.
In 2024, Jason and his team beat out the competition and took home the World Series title.
The team I'm on right now, we're called the Courage Rolling Twins. This is our 11th year together. We won it last year.
Jason says winning is great, but for him, it's not the most important thing about the sport.
I love the guys I play with. I love the guys who coach us. It's just my second family, and it's dope as hell.
You can learn more at wheelchairsoftball.org. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSell.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Court of Appeals has overturned the felony conviction of an Enbridge Line 3 protester, citing misconduct by the prosecutor. That's according to a report from Amper's member station KAXE. In 2023, a jury convicted the protester of obstruction of justice. She attached herself to a bamboo structure during a protest at Enbridge's Swatara pumping station in central Minnesota back in 2021. The accused was sentenced to 1 year of unsupervised probation. But recently, the appeals court ruled she did not get a fair trial, pointing to at least 5 instances of serious misconduct by the Aiken County prosecutor at the time. The case now heads back to the district court for a new trial.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Communities negatively impacted by the fact that cannabis was once illegal are getting a big boost from the state. Then, a new team is adding a Latin influence to the national sport in South Central Minnesota. And it looks like Minnesota will end up being the home to 2 Hockey Halls of Fame. I'm Gracie J. The Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management has awarded CanRenew grants to 11 organizations. The grants fund projects that boost economic development, public health, youth programs, violence prevention, and civil legal aid. About 150 organizations applied, requesting more than $22 million, but the program is only able to invest $1 million in communities hit hardest by past cannabis prohibition and discriminatory law enforcement. The grants do not support cannabis businesses. Instead, they fund programs that make positive impacts. Programs will start within 90 days, and the next CanRenew round opens this winter. In today's main story, Minnesota's first all-Latino amateur baseball squad is creating a cultural force and giving Latino players and fans their own space within Minnesota's century-old town ball tradition. Jose Osoria has the story.
Minnesota has a long, rich baseball tradition that dates back to the 1800s. With the end of their 2025 season, the Willmar Indians have become the latest chapter in that story.
I moved here to Minnesota 2016 to play college ball at Ridgewater. My Ridgewater team was mainly Latino guys from Puerto Rico mostly.
That's Jean Carlos Morales. He's the founder of the Willmar Indians. His experience at Ridgewater College in Hutchinson sparked an idea.
I always got this idea to make a team to join the league. There is no Latino teams on the league.
Mr. Morales believed that an untapped talent pool existed, but that potential players were not pursuing baseball because of the language barrier.
They're afraid of us. They're like, no, I'm not going to go over there because I don't know if they're going to reject me or something, so I don't speak English. That was the main reason that I feel like I got to do this.
Mike Nagel is the treasurer of the Minnesota Baseball Association and the founder of the league the Indians are a part of. He says that the sound, the smell of the food, the atmosphere at the ballpark is uniquely different.
When you play the Willmar Indians in Willmar, they bring in food trucks that have Latino foods. And everyone that's been there said it's probably one of the coolest experiences they've ever had.
Mr. Nagel points out that like the teams in the past, the success of the Willmar Indians has reverberations beyond the baseball diamond.
This is way more than a bunch of guys who want to play baseball. This is a paradigm shift.
Minnesota as a whole has a great legacy of baseball.
Frank White is a baseball historian and author of the book, They Played for the Love of the Game, Untold Stories of Black Baseball in Minnesota.
You talk about town teams. I mean, that is still today, town team baseball is very popular. They have big crowds that still attend some of the games, the state tournament games.
Mr. White feels that the Willmar Indians are part of a larger tradition of baseball in the area, like the Minneapolis Gophers, who predated the Negro Leagues by several years, and the Negro League teams that toured the area.
Initially, the acceptance of Black players here was well received because of the popularity of people going to watch them play. I mean, they were a gate attraction.
Mr. Morales, the Willmar Indians founder, says he received some pushback about the team's name, leading him to seek approval from some of the local Native American communities. He believes that the name reflects the ancestry of the team's players.
Get some negative feedback, but saying we are Latinos. I mean, I take the name to represent our traits, our ancestors, and everything.
The Indians made it to their league's amateur tournament, where they won one game. Their season ended the first week of August, but the team will be back in action in early September when they participate in their fall classic tournament. For North Star Stories, I'm Jose Osoria.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame won't be moving to the Twin Cities after all. Instead, a group that wants to honor the sport is planning to build a new $70 million State Hockey Hall of Fame in the metro area. The goal is to break ground next year and open the facility in 2028. A development partner, corporate sponsors, and individual donors will fund the new Minnesota Hockey Hall of Fame. The plan calls for a professional-sized hockey rink that could host high school, college, and even professional games. Those creating the new facility say that rather than competing with them, they would like to partner with the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame in Eveleth.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, we're sharing a special extended conversation with a community member you've heard in earlier reports. Today, Travis Zimmerman's extended interview with Dr. Amber Annis of the Native Governance Center. Let's listen.
Mahami Takyapi, Amber Annis Imachyapi.
My name is Amber Annis. I am a citizen of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. I'm an Ekoju Lakota. I was born and raised in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, which is on the Cheyenne River Reservation. But I've lived here in St. Paul for the past 12 years now. And I have just stepped into the position of the executive director of the Native Governance Center.
Well, thank you. Native Governance Center. How long has the organization been around? What's its mission? Tell us more about that, please.
Native Governance Center, we have been around since 2015. At the time, we did have a physical space, so we did open our doors in 2015. And the Native Governance Center really emerged in response to a need that were being identified by tribal leaders, the 23 Native nations that share geography with Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, but also beyond. And a need that we were hearing was having a structure or a system in place that was dedicated to assisting Native nations, Native citizens, and strengthening tribal governance systems, but also our capacity to how to exercise sovereignty. We're a grassroots organization, and what we really do is serve those Native changemakers and elected tribal leaders.
Great. Well, thank you. What interested you in the position? What drew you to jump from what you're doing with the Historical Society into the executive director position at the Governance Center?
Well, you know, I have been familiar with Native Governance Center since its very beginning, since its inception, because it was a pretty unique concept, I would say, an organization solely dedicated to helping Native people and Native nations thrive within their own terms, looking very specifically at working with tribal leaders. So I've been familiar with it for a long time, and I am a part of the Code 11 Native Nation Rebuilders. That's one of our main programs out of Native Governance Center, the Native Nation Rebuilders, a leadership program. When I joined that program, I was really able to see the profound work that Native Governance Center was doing. I was able to spend 2 years with amazing folks, you know, across Indian country, learning from tribal elected leaders, some amazing Native elders, but also my cohort itself, you know, these amazing Native folks across Indian country that we all kind of came together with this same purpose, which was, how am I as a Native citizen? How are we, wherever we may be, right, in our place in life, what are we doing? How are we standing with our nations where we're at? Whether that's you're living back home in your community, whether that is you're living in an urban area, how are we going back to our own traditional kind of forms of self-governance, but also at the same time, how are we doing that in a contemporary way?
What are some of your goals working with the Governance Center and working with the existing programs, or maybe developing new programs?
In terms of vision and thinking about the future, Native Governance Center, we're at a really pivotal moment right now, I would say. We are at a moment where we are well-funded, well-supported, but we have to also think about what sustainability means for us as a Native-led organization, a nonprofit. We really have to think, how are we sustaining ourselves in the future? So a hope and a goal of mine is to really try to think of how we can become a little bit more independent from those larger, amazing funds, right, that those donors and the funds that we have that we steward. How are we actually engaging, when we say engaging with Native nations, how are we looking to Native nations to really truly support and commit to the work that their own citizens, right, our citizens of Native nations, how are we investing in our own people? And so I look forward to that. I look forward to those conversations. We are always looking for those folks that see the value in the work that we're doing and would like to be a part of our mission and would like to be a part of this larger network of change makers within Indian country.
Well, thanks a lot, Amber. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Travis. Pilame Aye, and Pilame Aye to all the listeners. And again, visit nativegov.org.
That's all for this week. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Support for KFAI comes from Crooner's Supper Club, presenting an acoustic evening with songwriter Mary Cutrafello, Thursday, September 11th. Country Americana singer, songwriter, guitarist, and performer, Mary Cutrafello will be performing acoustic selections for the entirety of her 35-year career in the intimacy of the Dunsmore Jazz Room. From a 1983 rock opera Pool of Fire to tried and true classics to brand new and as of yet unrecorded material. More information about an acoustic evening with songwriter Mary Cutrafello is available at croonersmn.com.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Ramsey and Washington County. Stick it to sharps. Medical sharps like injector pens, needles, syringes, and lancets do not belong in the trash. They can break through bags and injure workers.